Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here, where...
Welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour. This is your co-host, Fanny Crawford.
And Stash Ziolkowski.
And we're here today on November 12th, 2018. And our theme today on the Storytelling Hour is games. This is enlightenradio.org. And we're so glad you're joining us.
And I'm so glad you're back.
Oh, well, I was only gone a week, Stash.
Already the show is better. Doing a show alone is kind of, I don't know.
It's not nearly as interesting right. When there's only one of us. Right. It's true. Yes. I totally agree with that.
Yeah. Nothing I said was funny.
Oh, that's not true.
And if I was trying to be funny, I'm sure it wasn't then.
You just weren't listening to yourself. No,
I guess I was trying not to.
So, how are you?
I'm fine.
Me too.
Lots of good things happening in storytelling and lots of good things coming up. And I'm fine.
Good.
And I expect December 16th in the evening, I'm going to be able to relax.
From then on.
For a while, anyway. Okay.
Well, sometime during this hour, I want to talk about where I was when I wasn't here, because that was very exciting.
I'm sure.
And I've already told you a fair amount about that, but mm-hmm. I might repeat some of that.
Can listen again. It'll be good.
For our listeners.
You might change things this time.
That's true. It might be a whole different story.
Right.
Well, what do you want to do first?
Well, I guess we could jump right in with the story.
Oh, okay.
Okay, you have a story?
I do.
Well, why don't we begin with your story?
Okay. This story is called Stones. I remember playing a game with a group of 8 or 10 kids, most of them a little older than I was. I was 6 years old, close to turning 7, I think. This was in West Philadelphia, near the Philadelphia Zoo, where I grew up. It was after school, late afternoon, when I would have been on my way to my friend Paula's house, where I went every day after school till it was time for my parents to be home from work. And we were all of us kids standing in front of a garage across the street from Paula's house, a little residential garage, like the kind attached to a house, but I don't remember if this one was attached or not. And I was we were all throwing stones at a cat up on the roof of the garage. I know it's shocking, isn't it?
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. It was hard for me to think about telling this story. I've never told this story before. Okay. I don't know why we decided to throw stones at a cat. Maybe we were trying to get the cat to come down. I don't remember how it started or who threw the first stone. But the cat was flattening itself against the roof to try to protect its head and its soft parts. But all of the cat would not fit behind the little obstacle. It was a tar paper covered box or something that was up there. It was trying to hide behind this little box-shaped thing up on the roof. And I think Paula, who was my closest friend in that group, had been there at the beginning of this activity, but she'd wandered off home. She was not very interested in the stone throwing, but I was intrigued. Now, we had a whole village of feral cats that lived in the alley behind my backyard at my house, maybe 8 blocks away from Paula's house. And I loved cats. We had had a cat of our own, Puss Puss, that I loved dearly when I was very young, but we didn't have a cat when I was 6. And the feral cats behind our house were a strain apart. They were not friendly to me. They'd hiss and jump sideways on their toes with their backs arched and their hair standing on end, spitting at me if I tried to get close to them. They were a little scary. And my mother was constantly telling me not to touch them because we didn't know what kind of diseases they had. So those were not my favorite cats. But after throwing one or two stones at this cat on the garage roof and missing my target each time, I started handing stones to the girl who was standing next to me. She was bigger than me, maybe a year older, and I knew her a little bit. She was a neighbor of Paula's on that street. She accepted a couple of stones from me and threw them at the cat. But after that, when I tried to hand her another stone, she said, "Uh-uh, you want me to get in trouble. Throw your own stones." Well, she was friendly still, but I knew she saw right through me. I'd not been clear in my own head why I was handing her the stones until she said that. This was a game. I thought the point was to hit the cat. And since I wasn't having any luck, I told myself the stones were better hurled by someone with a better chance of hitting the cat. I was enjoying the thrill of a not entirely appropriate activity. But it was not until the girl said that to me that I understood some of the downside of this game and the real reason I was not so willing to throw stones. We could get in trouble here. Well, the next summer, my first summer at College Settlement Farm Camp, my first overnight camp without my family, was run by Quakers under the supervision of a couple of friends' meetings. In the first few days I was there, I found myself in the center of a group of five or six kids who were playing a game with stones one evening after dinner. This time, the target was another child. I thought it was just a game and was enthusiastically picking up stones and throwing them at that other child. I didn't know these kids very well yet. I certainly didn't know the child at whom I was casting stones. I'd only thrown four or five stones when the game was interrupted by a couple of grown-ups, and I was taken up to my bunk. My bed was in a room on the second floor of the house that we called the Mansion House, where all the little kids lived and slept at camp. And this was my first year at camp, so I was in the little girl's cabin. I was a Powhatan. That's what our group was called. But none of the other Powhatan girls were in the room. I was sent to bed by myself. While it was still daylight, I was told, because I'd been throwing stones at another person, and that would not be tolerated. Well, I didn't argue the point. I had been throwing stones at a person, but I thought it was a game. Now, 2 weeks later, when I got home, for some reason, I felt compelled to tell my mother this story. And by that time, I had thought of what I was sure was a brilliant subterfuge. I told her I really was not throwing stones. Another kid was standing between me and the adult who caught us. He was throwing the stones. But because my hand and arm was raised up, for some reason, the counselor mistakenly thought that I was the culprit. My mother did not respond to this statement, and that was the end of the conversation. And it was a year or two later that I decided she could not possibly have believed that excuse. But she didn't dispute it at the time. Well, I haven't thrown any stones since then, except a flat rock or two or three, trying to skip them across the Schuylkill River in Philadelphia, or the Potomac in Shepherdstown. But that is a real game. My dad tried to teach me to skip stones, but I was really better at trying to hit cats and kids. That's my story.
Has your husband ever heard that story?
I don't think so.
It's good. Since I know he loves the cat dearly.
I would never throw stones at a cat now. But it is fascinating to me how I just missed the part about that not being nice or safe or any or endearing to other people and cats.
You sound like the person who pleads not guilty, even though he was caught with the smoking gun.
Well, that's how I felt. I was shocked that I was put to bed in the daylight because I didn't know it was wrong. I mean, I kind of knew it was not quite right, but I didn't know it was a criminal offense. I really did not.
Yeah. Well, the story is, I guess. Like the story. I like the story very much, especially that part, because as a young person, so many times people do things and not until they're actually in the act for a while, you know, with a group especially, does it dawn on them then, maybe I shouldn't be doing this.
That's right. Maybe this was not such a good idea.
Right. So anyway, it reminded me of one of my absolute favorite short plays called The Lottery.
Ah, and is it a two-person play?
No. No. Oh, no. but it is a wonderful play for a group to read.
Oh, yeah.
How
many parts?
Probably seven.
Oh, my gosh.
Speaking parts. But mostly three or four lots of words, and then could have as many as 15 or 20 people. When I was teaching at Frederick High School, one of the students that was in drama productions, I worked with an English teacher who did drama, and he and I became partners in the evening drama program. We did two shows a year. One, a play, and he directed those, and I did props and things for it and managed the kids. And in the spring, we did musicals, and for four years, I directed the musicals. Well, the second year I was there, one of the outstanding students in the school came and said, we would like to do a play on our own. There were two seniors, actually, who wanted to try directing a play, but they needed an adult to be there for rehearsals. And this was just maybe 3 weeks before the Christmas break. And I wasn't coaching anymore, so I said, sure, I don't mind. That'd be fun. I'll sit in the auditorium and just be like a monitor or something. And they picked the play, The Lottery. And the play is about a small town who every year they chose, they would go to a kind of like a polling place where the whole town gathered, and they would choose out of a box that had their kind of ballots, but the ballots were, you didn't write on them and you didn't actually like enter them any place. They were in envelopes and you picked out an envelope, and when you opened it up, if it had a certain color card in it, you had been the winner of the lottery. And the prize was not a very good one, because they use this, it's kind of a weird twist on the idea of sacrifices. The person who was the chosen one by the lottery was stoned to death.
Is this in contemporary United States?
I don't think so. I think it's in an imaginary place.
That's good.
But it could be in the United States. The way the two young men staged it was brilliant. They made it like a small town. Mm. And there was never any mention of where it was. But the impression, if you just sat and listened to it, was like, oh, this is one of those small country places where the people have to walk to the church or walk to the store and things. And it was a big hit.
Wow.
They were given permission to present it.
I'm getting chills. And
yeah, I was real impressed with
them.
And it was a big hit, and it was also a very scary production because they had done such a good job. And the woman who was chosen to be stoned, the actress, was a ninth grader who, for her whole 4 years in high school, was one of the leads or second leads mm-hmm. in lots of shows and went on to perform with the Fredericktown Players
mm-hmm.
and was a wonderful actress. So it was a good experience from that point, but the show was very chilling, and I would love to direct it with adults.
I guess I'm going to have to be very careful about where I tell my story.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think it's an interesting personal narrative about the same kind of feelings and, you know, right and wrong,
mm-hmm.
because they discuss that very much in that play. How it's not fair, but it has to be done.
Does anybody's mind get changed?
Only the people in the audience. it's sort of the sacrificial lamb.
Yeah.
And that. A little bit scary. This is the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour with your co-host Stasia Olkowski and
Fanny Crawford.
And we are broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia, and telling stories about games. And Fanny just told a great story about a scary game. So, I think let's see. Shall we have a different story?
Well, before we do that, no. I realized that I have been remiss because I did our little introduction without acknowledging the music that our listeners heard was courtesy of Andy Offutt Irwin,
right.
Our good friend Andy Offutt Irwin.
Yes, and a mentor.
Yes, and yes. Tarry Here was that song, and we always want to give him credit and thank him for permission for beginning our show most weeks with that piece. It is one of my favorites.
I would like to see a group do that song.
Okay.
The next time Andy is here for workshop, we should ask him if he would lead us in a group sing of that.
That's a good idea.
I think it'd be fun.
Okay.
Mm. So, why don't you say something about stories in the round?
Okay, I will say something about stories in the round. That's the storytelling series, of course, that I coordinate in Hagerstown, Maryland at the Unitarian Universalist Church at 13245 Sear Foss Pike, which is just a mile west of the city limits in Hagerstown. And I want to tell our listeners that on November 26th, we will be doing something a little unusual from the usual out-of-town storyteller that we bring in, March through December, usually on the fourth Mondays of the month. This time, although it will be on the fourth Monday of the month, Stash and I are doing a play, a two-person play. If you've been listening to the show this morning, you know that I've been a bit obsessed about two-person plays and asking Stash, is that a two-person play? Whenever he brings up theater. But we will be doing a play called The Guys, which you may remember has been done off-Broadway, on Broadway, and as well in the movies. So it is just the two of us, and we'll be portraying a journalist and a fire captain who are struggling with the aftermath of 9/11/2001. The fire captain needs to write eulogies for many of his men who were killed in the blast and the falling of the towers at the World Trade Center. And I will be playing the journalist who's helping him cope with that both the trauma of losing his men and getting these eulogies written. And in the process, they become friends. They are strangers when they meet, but drawn together by events. There are some light moments in the play. It is not unrelenting grimness, but it is a story for our time and the learning that goes on in the midst of trauma. So I'm looking forward to it. We've been rehearsing for months now. And do you have something you want to add?
I'm looking forward to it, too. I was going to say, maybe, no, I had a private aside conversation between the two of us is, maybe we shouldn't tell people we've been rehearsing for months. But that's always in my mind.
Well, it's true.
I know.
But partly because we are not professional actors. We have lives outside of this, so we don't have all that much time each time we meet. But it has been fun. I've been enjoying the process and learning. Every time we meet, I learn something about myself, something about the story, something about history, and maybe how to be more careful about what I agree to.
Maybe you learn something about me, too.
Oh, I always learn more about you. But that's part of being partners here on the radio and in the theater. So if our listeners would like more information about November 26th and The Guys being performed at Stories in the Round, you can call me, Fanny Crawford, at 301-730-1638. It's $10 in advance and $12 at the door. And you can ask more questions about that if you call me at 301-730-1638 or contact me via email at fanitsky, F-A-N-I-T-S-K-Y, at hotmail.com.
Yes.
So, what's next? Shall we? Are you going to tell a story now?
Yes.
Oh,
I'm going to tell a story. And my story... my story has a title, and the title is Red Line. And that's my best recollection of the name of this game, is Red Line, not L-I-O-N, but L-I-N-E. And Red Line is a game of capture. We played it in East Baltimore, in the city. And we were restricted in area to one square block. Usually there would be four boys on each team. That's not a sexist game now, but in the block that we lived in and played in and shared that territory, there were between 35 and 40 males between the ages of 2 and 20, which is an enormous population of young men. And there were only two or three females in most of my youth before I went in the Army in that area, which I seemed, it must have been a really strange situation for parents. I can only imagine 40 or even 35 young men in one square block. Though we did not throw rocks at cats. At least I didn't, but I think some of my friends probably did. Well, here it goes. Red Line is a game of capture. Four boys on the team. And the way it worked was we would flip a coin to see which team was it and which team was free. We were restricted to not crossing the street. The city block, of course, had an alley. So there was a border of four actual streets that we could not cross. We could cross the alley, certainly. And what we would do is next to a wall, and usually next to a house, someone's house, we would draw with chalk a line that covered two of the squares on the sidewalk. So the box would be about 4 feet deep and maybe 8 feet long. if you were caught by the team that was the chasers, they would take you to that box. You would have to stand there, or you could sit down if you wanted to on a cement. And you were stuck there until one of your teammates, in some bold move, would come running down the street or sneak down the street some way and touch the box, run through it, or just step into it. And then anybody who was in there was free. So usually they kept one person as a jailer, and the other three would be chasers. They'd be looking for the team that was out and free. Because we were restricted from going across any main streets, we wound up being very creative about places to hide. This tale is about myself striving to be the hero and set my team free. The game was always played after dark, because that gave us many more options for hiding. There were no restrictions about where you could go or how you would get there, as long as you didn't cross any of the main streets, and as long as you didn't, well, I guess that's the only one. So, on this particular evening, the box was drawn next to the stoop, the steps of the Martinez house. The Martinez family was the only Hispanic family in our neighborhood. We had mostly Germans, some and Polish families, a few maybe Russians, but only one Hispanic family. And the son in that family was probably 7 years old, very good baseball player for 7 years old. And we really liked him. We kept him active with our gang of boys, even though he was much younger than the group I was in. So on this night, I had made up my mind that I was going to try to be the hero if my team got caught. I was one of the smaller kids, and very seldom was I the hero. In no time at all, my three teammates were caught and put into the box. I was free. I was hiding behind a fence across the alley. There was a vacant lot where a house had burned down, and the lot was cleaned. There was no remnants of the fire, but there was a wall, and we often used to play games, different kind of ball games, throwing a ball against the wall instead of hitting it with a stick. We'd bounce the ball off the wall and had a small diamond set up for wall ball, like baseball. And I was on the other side of that wall, and there was a gate, and I was watching everything that was happening. There was no chance for me to get from that wall and run across the lot, which was only maybe 50 feet, and go across the alley, another, I guess, 14 feet wide, and run to the box and step in it to free my friends. I knew the only way I was going to be able to get to that box is if I came from the opposite direction. Unfortunately, the opposite direction meant I would have to get across the alley and come through someone's backyard. At one point, my three friends were sitting on the ground. Everybody seemed kind of bored. I was the only one free, and the jailer was standing on guard. The other three opponents were searching the block. At one point, no one seemed to be looking in my direction, and I made a mad dash towards the box, but halfway there, the one jailer noticed me coming, and I had no chance to get to the box before he would have touched me. So I veered off, ran up the alley, and took a left into somebody's another alley. Well, this is hard to explain because the alley was wide enough for a car to drive down. But then between houses, these were all row houses. Every one of them connected to the next one. And between the houses, there was an alley also that went to the person's backyard. And that alley served two backyards. I went through an alley into a person's backyard, over a fence, over another fence. And he, of course, could not have followed me because he was the jailer. So I worked my way through backyard alleys and fences until I was in my own yard. And then I hatched a plan. The fence at the back of my yard separated our house and our property from Miss Rose. Miss Rose was a nice lady who sat out in her garden lots of times and would drink tea. And in the summertime, she would sometimes sit there and sing. Well, this was at night. It was dark, and I knew she wouldn't be outside. So I had gone into my backyard. My parents, being after dinner time, were in the front room. And I went over the fence. I was in Miss Rose's yard. Well, Miss Rose's yard had a fence that was matched with the Martinez property. And I went over the next fence. And now I was in the backyard of the Martinez family. I was close, but the only thing that stood between me and the box where my friends were was a house. And there was no more fence to go over. And I hatched what was probably the worst plan ever of my young life. I went up to the back door of the Martinez house. I had to go up three wooden steps. I went up very carefully. And I was hoping I would not see anyone. In these row houses, very often there was a path from the back door through the kitchen, up a hallway to the front door. And you could see from the back door to the front door. And my heart sank when I realized that sitting just inside that back door with his back to me at the kitchen table was Mr. Martinez, reading the paper and I guess having a cup of coffee or maybe a snack. I had been hoping that he would be watching television. The front room and the dining room were off to the left of that hallway. I knew I couldn't wait too long, and in a moment of madness,
I found this on the web for television in the...
In a moment of madness, someone began speaking here in the studio.
That was a moment of madness.
It's a little impolite, but I don't even know who it was. So,
might have been Mrs. Martinez.
Right. In a moment of madness, I opened the back door, ran past Mr. Martinez's left shoulder, down the hallway, ripped open the front door, I didn't rip open the front door. At 10 years of age or so, I was not going to rip any doors. Opened the front door, jumped off the stoop and into the box, setting my friends free. I was immediately caught because when I landed in a box, I kind of twisted my ankle and the jailer got me, but the other three were free. They didn't catch the other three guys because in no time at all, Mr. Martinez came out and wanted to know what I had run through their house for. And then he saw that my ankle was bothering me, came down. He actually got some ice to put on my ankle. He was such a nice man. And he quizzed me, and I was so dumbfounded. I just didn't know what to say. So I kind of just didn't say anything. Well, about 15 minutes later, the guys started to work their way back toward the jail area, and Mr. Martinez told them that he thought it was time for the game to be over. And I asked one of the guys to walk me home. It wasn't very far. I just had to go down the street, just down the alley a little ways, and turn right onto Bank Street where we lived and go to my house. I thought it was all over. I had been the hero. I did have an ankle that was sore, wasn't broken or anything. I went in the house. My parents told me they thought I was out a little bit late. I should get ready to go to bed. And I thought, oh, that was what a great day. Unfortunately, the next day, Mr. Martinez came to our house when my father came home from work and explained to my father that he was confused about why I would run through their house. My father was confused about it also. 5 minutes after Mr. Martinez had come to the house, my father called me from my room, and the three of us had a meeting. I did very little talking. I tried to explain, but Mr. Martinez kept saying, I don't understand why you would run through my house. If you needed to go through the house, why didn't you knock on the door? And, you know, Mr. Martinez was not up for our games. He was a very serious man. I was dismissed from the room. My dad and Mr. Martinez talked some more. I was in the kitchen when they decided it was all over. They shook hands. Mr. Martinez left. And I spent the next 15 or 20 minutes trying to explain to my dad why I thought it was a good idea and that I knew now it was not a good idea. The incredible thing is that Mr. Martinez actually lobbied for me, according to my father, and said that I had never done anything like that before, and he didn't think I was really trying to break into his house. He thought it was a game, and he didn't understand why, but he didn't think I should be punished too severely. And so I wasn't punished too severely. But I can honestly say I have never open the back door of a house and run through it again. And that's the story of Redline.
Wow. I do love that story, and I especially love Mr. Martinez maintaining that adult befuddlement. Why would you do that? Little Stosh.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
But... He understood on some level.
He really did, and he never fussed at us.
Not letting you off the hook.
Yeah.
It was not civilized behavior. That's what he meant. Why would you?
Right. So, anyway, well, I'm glad you got a chuckle out of that. I'm hoping that it's going to be well received other places.
It's a great neighborhood story. It's a lovely story.
I worry about the description because I'm not sure I make the picture that clear. If you haven't ever lived in a city in row houses, it's a unique setup. People who live in what I would consider normal housing nowadays.
Suburbs, you mean.
Yeah, suburbs and that. In where I grew up in the city, every house faced either the alley or a main street. And so if you went on a main street and you walked to the corner, turned, and walked up the next main street, and walked to the corner and turned and walked to the alley, turned and went down, you would be walking in front of the front doors of houses on four different streets.
Yes.
Three streets and an alley. And therefore, the back door and the yard of every house was inside of that rectangle. And so there were a great many opportunities to go from yard to yard to yard to yard and travel without being on the street or the alley.
One of the first houses I lived my married life in had been suburban or had been rural, I guess, and was becoming more suburbanized, more urbanized. And I remember a friend standing in our yard and turning and looking both ways down through the other yards and saying, "Whoa, it's all over here. You can see to the end of the block through all of these yards," because the main trees or the dividing trees or shrubs had been taken down, and there were still some trees and bushes left, but you could see down through 5 or 6 yards on either side of our house. And I remember thinking, huh, it is a different kind of world.
It certainly is.
But I did grow up in a row house as a child, so I get it, how you can tour the neighborhood, never leaving the square block. Yeah.
Okay, so
you're going to talk about Speak, are you?
Speak stories.
Okay.
And today is the 12th of November. Tomorrow is November 13th.
Second Tuesday.
Right, second Tuesday. Before I forget.
Yes.
It's belated because of the date, but I hope all the veterans and their families had a happy Veterans Day. There are lots of things going on yesterday to celebrate veterans and the families. And I'm glad that people recognize the veterans and the sacrifices that they and their families, both male and female veterans, and the families, the sacrifices that they make to protect our country.
Thank you, Stosh.
So, the Speak Story series. Tomorrow, Megan Wells. And I am really excited about seeing Megan Wells, and I'm going to be able to go to dinner with her.
I think last night Megan Wells was in Philadelphia at Megan Hicks's house house concert.
I saw a post about that on Facebook,
yeah.
and I was surprised. I thought, well, that gives her plenty of time to drive down here. So, and actually, she's her daughter is with her.
Ah.
Her daughter is going to be with her because her daughter is soon heading off to college. I understand she's a senior in high school, and so she's traveling with her mother every chance she gets to see what her mother does.
That's a good thing.
That's neat. And members of our committee for the Speak Story series, if the storyteller coming in on the second Tuesday of each month wishes to go to dinner or lunch, members of the committee are invited to go along. And it's always a great experience to sit and share a meal and listen to some more stories by the great tellers that we have coming in. And Megan Wells has a lot of experience. She's been recognized nationally for her expertise, and I'm really excited to see her tomorrow night.
Me too.
And next month, on December 11th, Elizabeth Ellis will be back. The snowstorm in March canceled her performance and her workshop, and so she is coming back December 10th. She will be in Shepherdstown to do a workshop on family stories, and that's open to the public. If you would like more details about the cost and time and that, you could go to speakstoryseries.com, and there you will find all the details about this.
Whoa, there is a lot going on.
There is a lot going on. Next Friday,
the 16th,
in Sharpsburg, Maryland, just 4 miles from Shepherdstown, West Virginia, there will be a celebration, a national celebration of storytelling that is held sometime close to the Saturday before Thanksgiving each year. And this year there will be 5 storytellers in Sharpsburg, and we will be performing at the Victory Garden Ranch at 101 West Main Street. And the performance is free. It's a family event, and there is a bonus if you show up and you stay long enough to hear the stories. You will receive a ticket that will enable you to go across the street to Nutter's either that night or in the next week or so and get a free ice cream cone.
I've been meaning to ask you, do the storytellers get a free ticket for Nutter's ice cream also?
They will.
Oh, thank goodness. Okay. Well, then I guess I'll show up and tell stories.
Oh, thanks. And we will have Fanny will be telling a story. I will be telling a story. Larry Hayes will be telling a story. Renee Emanuel will be telling a story. And we've added a new person to the group that performed last year, Mark Brew, who is well known in the Sharpsburg area because he does ghost stories and walk ghost walk, and he is a historian and an author, and I'm excited to have him along with us.
It's going to be wonderful.
It will be wonderful. Then there's more coming up. November 26th in Hagerstown, The Guys, a play that Fanny and I will be doing, and
open mic on the 25th.
Open mic the day before at New Spire Arts in Frederick.
Yes.
At 115 Church Street.
East Church Street.
East Church Street. And
You can call if you want information about any of those options. If you want information about Telebration, you should call or contact Stosh.
501-253-4656.
And for The Guys at Stories in the Round and open mic at New Spire Arts in Frederick, you should contact me, Fanny Crawford, at 301-730-1638 or fennitsky at hotmail.com. And our theme for open mic on November 25th is reunions. The featured storyteller is Nick Newlin, and the co-host with me is Laura First. So lots of good stories. And you can tell stories yourself, listeners.
That's right.
Signing up for open mic.
Right. And then finally actually December 1st at Susan Gordon's house.
Oh, yeah.
There will be a holiday presentation. Susanna Connolly Holstein, West Virginia storyteller, and yours truly, Stasz Jokalski, will be performing holiday stories, Christmas stories, and doing some singing and having the audience join into that with some carols and Christmas songs. And finally, on December 2nd, back at the Victory Garden Ranch in Sharpsburg, Susanna Connolly Holstein and Stosh will be performing another holiday program at 3 o'clock in the afternoon at the Victory Garden Ranch, and that is a free performance.
Well, if we're talking about December, there's actually several other events in
I opened
December.
The gates.
You did. So there's another open mic session. And you, Stosh, will be my co-host for that. The theme is Family Traditions on the 16th of December. Correct. That's a Sunday, of course. And again, 115 East Church Street for New Spire Arts. And on Thursday, December 20th, the Mason-Dixon Historical Society, also known as the Middleburg, Pennsylvania Historical Society, will be meeting at State Line Ruritan, just over the Pennsylvania state line from Hagerstown, Maryland. And I will be telling T.H. Barnes will be telling holiday stories at that event at 6 p.m. So you can either go to the Mason-Dixon Historical Society website, or you can contact me again at 301-730-1638. And I'm very excited about that event, too.
December
stories in the round is a big secret so far.
Ooh, okay.
So we're not announcing that one, but next week I promise to have
next
something.
Week. Okay, yeah. That sounds good. Well, do you have another game story?
How much time do we have?
We have some time. If you don't, I do.
Let's see. I do. Um,
Well, we don't want to have too much dead air here. Well, so
okay. This story is called Bolivar Games. And we, of course, are in Bolivar, West Virginia. Okay. But that's not the Bolivar that this story refers to. This is T.H. Barnes' story. So we'll invite T.H. Barnes into the room.
Okay.
To tell this story about a game that my great-grandfather, Thomas Henry Barnes, played in old New York.
Okay.
T.H., welcome, great-grandpa.
Thank you, great-great-granddaughter. Well, at the New York Colored Orphans Asylum, there was a predictable routine to our meals. Breakfast consisting of bread and milk, quality the best, and quantity quite sufficient. In winter, chocolate or cocoa and cereals were served. We played until 8:30 each morning, and then school began at 9, opening with prayer and song before our lessons. Recess was always exactly at 10:30, more lessons, and then out at noon for dinner. Each day, there was a change of fare. Soup on Monday, stew, fish, roasts the rest of the days. And Friday was always a visitor's day, when we invariably had a full roast beef for dinner. School began again in the afternoon at 1, with another recess in the afternoon, and lessons finished at 4. Now, supper was served at 6, alternating mush and milk, rice, or cereals. This was about 1860, remember. So the meals were different then. Each meal, however, opened with prayer and song. Bedtime was 8 o'clock in winter and 9 in summer. All the children march in single file in perfect order to and from the dining room, the schoolrooms, and our bedrooms. Saturdays was a half holiday, and on Sundays the entire building was under the management of a single teacher. Rotated each week that all might have their share of responsibility among the teaching staff. Now, there was strict observance of Sunday in the tradition of the Friends meetings. Cold meals were the rule on that day, and no playthings were permitted. Sunday school was the province of teachers brought in from the community, frequently a visiting pastor or a lay person who came to provide a sermon or talk in the afternoon. Weather permitting, a few of us would also be selected to answer invitations to visit an outside Sunday school, and these were coveted opportunities. Holidays, Christmas, the New Year, Easter, 4th of July, were all high holidays for us at the home. Special foods for each season appeared, much of it gifted to the school from our generous donors, brought in wagons from fancy New York City shops like Acker Merrill Company or Ridley's, sweetmeats and candies from the best grocers, turkeys, duck, and geese from the butcher's wagon. Splendid carriages carrying grand ladies and their liveried attendants would bear packages, bundles of gifts and toys, books, and holiday fare. Well, at the 4th of July, we saved our money for the occasion in order to overindulge in firecrackers and powders. In the evening, we were permitted on the rooftop to observe private and municipal fireworks. The next day, any boy without a burn or a scar was considered unpatriotic and a traitor to his country. But I've not yet shared with you the most iconic of all of our celebratory foodstuffs, the Bolivar cake.
This was a unique feature of our Sunday evenings. After that interminable day of quiet contemplation, philosophy and theology, and cold meals eaten in silence, respectful of the day, in the late afternoon came the distribution of these specially prepared cakes, carefully wrapped in special parchment paper, with a minimum of 2 cakes to each child, the intent being 1 cake consumed that very evening and 1 to set aside as a treat later in the week. The dimensions of the thing was about 4 inches across, approximately 1 inch thick, more or less round, but with uneven edges. The composition was not patented nor copyrighted, but no infringement was ever known. Ingredients were unlimited in variety, often seasonal, as availability of different grains or flours, fruits, seeds, and nuts varied. The basics were dark wheat flour, augmented at times with fine ground corn, grits, barley meal, or oats, with the addition of molasses, raisins, citron, figs, dates, berries, any dried fruit to mix with the nuts, and ground seeds, sunflower seeds or sesame seeds. Now, we children believed there was also some magical or alchemical ingredient that made the cakes insoluble and therefore indestructible, facilitating their use both as weapons of combat as well as medium of exchange. Bolivar cakes were therefore an important element of most of our pastimes and games during the week when classes were halted for recess or were over for the day. Bolivar handball, stickball games among the boys, Bolivar hopscotch, and a sort of street pickup jacks game played with a small ball, the smallest cakes substituting for the metal jacks to see how many cakes could be held in a closed fist as the ball was bounced and another cake taken up to add to the cluster in hand. Now, for purposes of trade and indigenous commerce within the school, Bolivar cakes were variable in value depending on the time of year and how generous the cooks had been with the week's cake supply. Receivable for all debts, 1 or more bolivars for a top, a ball, or a knife. The most entrepreneurial among us were often seen with a half dozen or more cakes bulging from their pockets or wrapped in a handkerchief or stored in a cap. And yet with all that, when well masticated, the bolivar still made respectable, even palatable, and good digestible eating. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Barnes.
Thank you, great grandpa.
Sounded like building blocks for everything.
Yes, indeed. Well, that's great grandpa's story, T.H. Barnes's story about Bolivar cakes from his childhood at the New York Colored Orphans Asylum in Manhattan, circa 1860. We are closing out this episode of the Enlighten Radio Storytelling Hour. Would you do that for us,
Stosh? I will be glad to. This is Stosh Ciolkowski and
Fanny Crawford,
your co-hosts for the Noontime Enlighten Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org, independent community radio in Bolivar, West Virginia. Closing out this week's show, the Storytelling Hour offers listeners a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional storytellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all of our stories. Thanks for listening.